Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. When veterans' hospital patients on the road to recovery suddenly die in increasing numbers, it's up to VA Special Agent in Charge Bruce Sackman to find out why. His shocking discovery rips open the hidden world of what goes on behind the bedside curtains when a killer doctor or nurse decides a patient must die. Behind the murder curtain is the true story of Bruce Sackman, Special Agent in Charge of the Department of Veterans Affairs Office of Inspector General. Sackman's main responsibilities had been investigating white-collar crimes, such as embezzlement, when he is drawn into the macabre world of doctors and nurses who murder their patients. Sackman evolves from an investigator of routine cases to the world's leading expert on medical serial killers, MSKs, doctors and nurses who ply their evil trade hidden behind the privacy curtain at a patient's bedside. Behind the Murder Curtain tells how this dedicated investigator brought down four MSKs in veterans' hospitals while developing the Red Flags Protocol, which is now taught to investigators and forensic nurses throughout the world as a tool for stopping an MSK. The book that we're featuring this evening is Behind the Murder Curtain. Special Agent Bruce Sackman hunts doctors and nurses who kill our veterans. With my special guest, Special Agent and journalist and author Bruce Sackman. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Bruce Sackman.
And thank you very much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to having an important discussion about this very interesting topic.
Absolutely, absolutely. Congratulations on this book. It's, as I said before the program, it really takes the reader along on this journey to put away some of the most terrible serial killers in history here, the medical serial killers, really preying on the most vulnerable of all. Let's first talk about, we mentioned the Special Agent in Charge of Veterans Administration Office of Inspector General, and that's a mouthful, VAOLA, OLG, pardon me. And you said it in your book, you're responsible for an area ranging from West Virginia to Maine, including 250,000 Veterans Administration employees. Tell us just a little bit about what the Special Agent in Charge, and we talked about it in the beginning of what you were typically employed to do. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. Well, I think it was around 1978, Congress actually created offices of inspector generals in just about every major federal agency. And the purpose of OIGs, as they're known, Office of Inspector Generals, is to ferret out fraud, waste, and abuse in the programs of that particular agency. So before I came to the VA, I did similar work in the Department of Defense. And then in 1980, I came over to the VA as a special agent and eventually rose to the position of special agent in charge. And in that capacity, I was responsible for all major criminal investigations for all the VA hospitals and regional offices, outpatient clinics from West Virginia to Maine. But normally, my normal investigative inventory was white-collar crime cases, you know, embezzlements, frauds, bribery, theft. It wasn't until I got a call one day from the chief of psychiatry at the Northport VA Hospital sort of changed my life. That's when she called me up and she said, Bruce, you're not going to believe this, but we actually have a doctor working here. And there's a news story about him where he was in prison for poisoning his coworkers and now he's working here as a doctor. How could that be? That was a great question.
Right.
And that's what started me on this journey that took me really now all over the world doing these kind of cases.
Now, you talk about this was October 95, and as you mentioned, you got a call from Dr. Thomason, if I mispronounce her name, at the psychiatrist at Northport. And
correct.
you introduce your partner, which is a little bit different than you, and you describe both your characters, but you guys are a dynamic partnership. Tell us a little bit about this Agent Tom Valerie.
Yeah, well, Agent Tom Valerie and I were, you know, sort of polar opposites in a lot of respects. Tom was really a rough and tough, you know, he was a volunteer fireman. He was incredible. He would fight a fire all night and then change his clothes and come to work the next day. He's actually the kind of guy that you'd want to have if you were in a foxhole. And me, I'm a little different. I'm more of your white-collar crime, Brooks Brothers dress type of investigator, you know, more of a scientific approach than he's more of a Dirty Harry, and I was more of a Columbo,
yeah.
I think would be the easiest way to describe it.
Yeah. Now, you guys had, he had mentioned to you, and then you had missed this program, but we talked about this program that was on 2020, I believe, but they talked about that this Double O Swango, License to Kill, Doctor Death, and they were talking about killing patients at this hospital, and they mentioned about the poisoning of paramedics previously. Now, with that, you said your duty was to get the bottom of the Swango story. What's the first thing you did? You talk about meeting up with a VA police chief. Tell us what you did first in this duty to get to the bottom of the Swango story.
Well, the first thing I did, I grabbed Tom and I said, well, let's hop in the car. We were in Manhattan. Let's hop in the car and go out and meet this guy. So we go to his dorm room, and I'll tell you something. He was an incredibly handsome, charming, personable sociopath. You know, if I didn't know better,
yeah.
I'd want to introduce him to my own daughter. He was a handsome
yeah.
ex-Marine doctor. Seemed like
yeah.
the perfect catch, you know.
Sure.
And so we started
yeah.
asking him. We're saying, you know, we got information that you were actually, you know, in prison for poisoning people. And he starts going this routine. Oh, no, you know, that's just media hype. It's not true. I was actually in jail. You know, I was a tough ex-Marine, and I got in a barroom brawl. But the governor of the state actually restored my civil rights. And he was so cool and so charming. He was actually a little too cool and too charming. And Tom and I are looking at each other and we're going, there's something not right here. This guy is just too cool and too charming. So we left because we didn't have any evidence that he actually harmed anybody at the VA hospital. And we tried to get a search warrant, but the U.S. attorney at the time said, well, you know, Bruce, you don't have any evidence that anybody was harmed in Northport. Well, the next thing you know, Swango leaves. We don't know where he went. Turned up in Africa. Turned up in Zimbabwe, Africa. And when he's in Zimbabwe, he killed women and children and pregnant women. Really, everybody was sort of just the target of opportunity for him. And then we started to do his whole background investigation. So who is this guy? And how did he get to us after spending time in jail for poisoning people? I couldn't believe it, that we could actually hire a doctor who spent years in prison for poisoning his coworkers. It seems like an impossible story that nobody would believe. But when you start to look in the background of Michael Swango, it's very, very scary. You know, it actually starts when he was in medical school in Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. And he would visit patients, and the patients would just die unexpectedly.
Right.
Nobody really made a big stink of it. They just refused to believe that he was actually responsible for patients' coding. Well, he didn't really do his homework too well, and they kept him in medical school for a year longer. But, you know, his fellow students wrote a letter to the dean, and they said, you know, Dean, we don't think Swango should be a doctor. we don't trust this guy. And the dean said, I don't care what you think. You're only students. I'm the dean. We'll keep this guy a little longer, and we'll make him we'll make him a doctor. So he becomes a doctor. Next thing you know, he does his internship at Ohio State University, and once again, patients start dying unexpectedly. Now, there was one particular patient. It's a very moving story. Her name was Cynthia McGee. Cynthia McGee was a young gymnast. She actually got in a car accident. She was hit by another student. She's improving until she gets a visit from you-know-who, Dr. Swango. Next thing you know, she dies unexpectedly. So the police go out, and they charge this other student who hit her in the car with vehicular homicide. But he didn't kill Cynthia McGee. It was actually Swango that killed Cynthia McGee. Well, the Ohio State people started to look at some of the cases that Swango was doing, but they couldn't develop enough evidence to charge him with anything. So Swango leaves. He becomes a paramedic. He goes back to his hometown of Quincy, Illinois. He becomes a paramedic. And one day he invites the paramedics in for donuts. You know, they worked hard at night. They want to have donuts. So what he does is he sprinkles arsenic on the donuts and leaves. Then they all get sick. And he starts calling up each one of them. He wants to know all the details of their sudden illness. Well, exactly what happened? And, you know, and then did you throw up? Did you have stomach pains? Did you have this? Did you have that? He was actually sort of reliving the thrill of the experience of these people getting sick. Well, these people were pretty smart, and they called the police, and the police did a search warrant of his home, and they found arsenic, and they found books on poisoning. So he got sentenced to 5 years in jail. And you would say, well, that's the last we're going to ever hear of this guy. Well, not true. Not true, because he came out of prison, fooled around with some name changing there for a while, and came up with this story, you know, being an ex-Marine, and he was in a barroom fight, and he brings out this piece of paper showing that the governor of the state of Virginia has restored his civil rights. Everything was totally bogus. But back then, you know, pre-internet days especially, you know, physician credentialing was not like it is today. And they said, okay, great, come on board. We need doctors. We need doctors. And the next thing you know, he's at a hospital out west, and he's doing great. He's doing great. He meets a young lady. They get engaged. He actually makes the mistake of reapplying for membership in the AMA. And the AMA discovers his background, and the next thing you know, everybody in the town is talking about him. There are radio shows talking about him, so it's time for him to leave again. And this really affects his fiance. So his fiance leaves him, goes home, goes back to mom and dad, and said, you know, I really love this Michael Swango. I feel so terrible. I feel like my whole life is coming to an end. So she goes to a park, takes out a gun, blows her brains out right in the park. Well, you can't blame Swango for that, can you? Well, yes, you can. Because even though the body was cremated, mom kept a lock of her hair. And we had the hair tested, and it was loaded with arsenic. Swango was even poisoning his own fiance. Everybody for him was a target of opportunity. So then eventually he winds up in my hometown, the Northport VA. Now, what's really interesting here is that the Northport VA, he went for a residency, and guess in what field? In psychiatry. So what does that mean? That means that you have to go in front of a board of trained psychiatrists and convince them all that you should be in their residency program. And he was such a smooth talker, so calm, so glib, that he fooled this entire board of trained psychiatrists and said, yeah, come on the program. We love you. Come on on. Next thing he knows, to the VA, and that's where he meets me. He goes to Africa. He kills people, anybody and everybody he met. I think he either killed or tried to kill in Africa. And then he was going to go on, I think it was to Saudi Arabia, but he had to get his passport renewed. So he comes back to the United States, and we arrested him, but not for murder, because we didn't have any proof that he had murdered anybody at the VA. But we had plenty of proof that he lied on his application to the VA about being in prison for poisoning his coworkers. So
right. He
pled guilty to that, and he got 3 years in jail. Now we had a window of 3 years to try to prove that he had killed people at the VA hospital in Northport. And this became a federal crime, and the reason why it's a federal crime is because the VA hospital is on the exclusive it's called the exclusive territory of the United States. It's like a military base. So even though it's on Long Island, it's a federal case because the VA hospital is on federal property. So what we did, this is when I first met Dr. Michael Bodden. Dr. Michael Bodden, one of the world's preeminent forensic medical examiners. And I went to him and I said, Dr. Bodden, tell you the truth, I've never done a homicide case. Never. I'm basically a white-collar crime guy, but I know I've got a killer here. Can you help me? And, you know, I met him up at the New York State Police. And the New York State Police, they didn't want to get involved in the case. But Michael Bodden said, Bruce, I'm your man. I'll do it with you, and I'll teach you. So I was fortunate enough to have as my private tutor, you might say, you know, the world's best forensic medical examiner. And he told me exactly what to do. He says, Bruce, what we have to do, we have to look at all the medical records of all the patients that were at the VA Northport at the time that Swango was there. And we have to try to make a determination based on a review of the medical records if any of these people died when they should not have died. In other words, they did not die from their direct disease processes. It was not a natural death. It was a poisoning. And Michael Bonin describes natural death like this. He says, Bruce, natural death is like if you shut off a fan and the blaze just gradually stop. But these people, he says, were bright like a light bulb, and like you turn off the light bulb and they're dark. So they're bright 1 minute and they're dark. And we found a number of patients that were actually improving before they met Swango. The family would go on vacation. They say, okay, Dad, I'm so glad to see you're improving. You know, we're going to Disney World. We'll see you when we come back. Only to get a call from Michael Swango that, you know, Dad had expired unexpectedly. So what was the murder weapon? Well, that was not an easy thing to determine, all right? We had to show that the deaths were consistent with some sort of poisoning. In the case of Michael Swango, it was something called succinylcholine. In the hospital, they referred to it as sux. What it is a drug that they give you if they want to put a tube down you to intubate you. The other drug is called epinephrine, which is adrenaline, which will speed up the heart. And we made a determination, first by reviewing the medical records, that a number of patients, and we narrowed it down to about three or four patients that died when they should have not have died. There was no reason in the medical records to determine why the patients died when they did. You know, a lot of times if you have a family loved one in the hospital, they're really sick, you know that they're going to pass. The staff knows that they're going to pass. It's
right.
not unexpected. But these people all died unexpectedly. Well, the next thing we had to do after looking at the medical records, we had to exhume the bodies. Now, I had never done anything like this before in my life, okay? Next thing I know, we're ringing the doorbells of the family members. And we're saying, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, I'm from the VA. I'd like to have your permission to exhume your father's body from the cemetery because we think some foul play has happened. Could you imagine getting a visit like that? Can you imagine hearing something like that? Incredible. But the people were super nice. They were really nice. And they said, okay. You know, okay. But we had a court order anyway. So next thing you know, for the first time, I find myself in a cemetery, and there's a backhoe, and the backhoe is moving all the dirt, and then all of a sudden, you know, there's a crane, and it comes, and it picks up the coffin from the ground. I had never done anything like this. I'm looking at my partner, I'm going, boy, we really started something here, didn't we?
Yeah.
Next thing I see, Michael Bonin jumps into the ground where the coffin had been, and he's taking soil samples. And I'm saying, Dr. Bonin, what is that for? He says, well, you know, Bruce, if there's arsenic in the soil, and we find arsenic in the body, they're going to claim that the arsenic from the soil kind of seeped into the body, and that's why there's arsenic in the body, not because of poisoning. So we take the body to the local medical examiner, and I had never been in a morgue before, and I saw people cut up in various states, and the next thing you know, we're opening up the coffin, and we pull the body up, and Michael Bonin and the local medical examiner out on Long Island, his name was Dr. Charles Wetley, and I'm just sitting there watching and learning, and they're cutting the body open, and they're examining parts, and they made a determination that these people did not die from what was on their death certificate, which is almost always the same, being myocardial infarction or some sort of heart ailment. And Dr. Bond said, there's nothing wrong with this guy's heart. Look at that. And he'd take it out and he'd show it to me like I knew what I was looking for. And I was, okay, doc, if you say that. You know, yeah, first time anybody handed a heart to me. And he's showing me this, and then he's saying, no, look, Bruce, we have to do the toxicology, and that's going to take time because I'm pretty certain that these people were poisoned. And it looks like it's consistent with either an epinephrine or a succinylcholine. And that's when I met Dr. Reeders. Now, Dr. Reeders is the owner of the National Medical Services, probably the world's, I don't know if it's the largest, but certainly one of the most prestigious private forensic labs in the world. And I said, how are we going to find this in embalmed tissue? How do you find traces of epinephrine and succinylcholine in embalmed tissue? And he said, hey, Bruce, don't worry. He says, we have this new machine. It's called the high-pressure liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometer. Holy cow. What the hell is that? I said, don't worry about it, Bruce. But what we do is we actually take a sample and we test it and it runs up and down and we test it through all this and we come out and we're pretty sure what we found. And based on that machine, he says, we found succinylcholine and epinephrine in bodies of these veterans that should have never had those drugs. Those drugs should have never been administered to them. And now it's time for Swango to come out of jail. Remember, we sent him in jail for lying to the government, not for murder.
That's right.
And he thought he was just going to walk away. Not so fast, Michael Swango, not so fast, okay? Because we're preparing an indictment charging you with the murder of three veterans at the Northport VA Medical Center. And by the way, Michael, if we go to trial, and even if we should lose the trial, your troubles are not over because the government of Zimbabwe has just issued an extradition for you. So, you know what? If we lose, we're just going to put you on the plane and drop you off on the tarmac in Zimbabwe. Good luck, buddy, over there. Okay? So, Michael Swango decided to plead guilty and save us the trouble and actually the family. Really, the trouble of going through a trial and listening through all this. And then it was time for his sentencing. And he stands up in front of the federal judge out on Long Island. And the judge asks him, he says, all right, explain to me, Dr. Swango, exactly what you did. And Dr. Swango, standing at attention like a Marine, said, you know, I poisoned these people using a paralytic. He didn't actually mention the drugs. But he said a paralytic. And then the doctor asked him to explain, then the judge asked him to explain exactly what succinylcholine is, exactly what epinephrine is. He did, never showed any remorse for his victims at all. Never the slightest remorse for any of that. Sort of reminded me of like the Nazi war criminals at the Nuremberg trial. And then as I'm then he sits down and his defense attorney puts his arm around Michael Swango like he's a poor victim here.
Sure.
It was one of the most disgusting things I had ever seen. I said, are you kidding me? This guy killed people all over the world, but, you know. So then it was time for sentencing. And Judge Mishla, who was the judge, he said something I have never heard before or since. He sentenced Michael to 3 consecutive life terms without the possibility of parole in Supermax Federal Penitentiary in Florence, Colorado, the most secure in the United States. And he said, and by the way, Dr. Swango, if for some reason Congress should change the law and allow you to appeal, your appeal is denied in advance. Holy cow. And I didn't even know if such a thing was even legal, but I said, wow, that's great. I had never heard
quite
anything
the
like that.
Quite the provision.
Yep. Yeah. And that was sort of a quick overview of my life with Dr. Swango, which, by the way, that's a very short version of a 7-year investigation.
You talked about how on earth, and this is always the thing that confounds me and other people when they read these stories, how was it on earth that he bamboozled not just one hospital, but so we didn't go into exactly how he did that. He did have the lie that the governor had basically restored his civil rights. I'd never heard of anything like that. And you say, well, it's interesting there'll be the governor of Virginia anyway, in the state that he wasn't in. But the other things, that there was other things in your investigation that you found that were crucial in each one of these medical centers that they went to that they didn't do a criminal background check, like you say that this would be standard.
Yeah, you know, physician credentialing has changed radically, thank God, since the Swango days. And I tell you, I'll give you my opinion why Swango was so successful, particularly at this particular time in our history. You know, a lot of these hospitals were somewhat remote, and they had a lot of foreign applicants. And all of a sudden, here comes somebody they haven't seen in a long time, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed ex-Marine. They said, wow, you know, we have all these applicants from India, from China, and here comes a blonde-haired, blue-eyed ex-Marine. Wow. So they started to overlook, I think, some of the things they might normally have delved into in greater detail just because they were so surprised and somewhat happy to see an applicant that looked and spoke like Michael Swango.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. And you say he's in Florence, Colorado for the rest of his life. With this investigation as well, with the Swango, which again, you talk about this being your first foray into much more serious crime. Obviously, when you're dealing with serial killers and you've jumped from where you working on white-collar crime, when we come back, we're just going to use this as an opportunity to stop to talk about our sponsor, which is Talkspace. Tonight's episode is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company that lets you message a licensed therapist from anywhere at any time. All you need is a computer or the Talkspace mobile app. That means you can improve your mental health even if you've had trouble making time for it in the past. Get something off your chest whenever you need to. Talk about everyday challenges at work or at home. Just talk about your life. There are no extra commutes, no leaving the office. Talkspace is there wherever you are, whenever you are ready to talk. Therapy isn't just about venting your most private thoughts or exploring childhood memories. It's also about practical everyday strategies for stress management and living a happier life. Having a therapist simply provides you a designated person for you to talk to, that person trained to listen and help you make positive changes. Talkspace platform has over 2,000 licensed therapists who are experienced in addressing life challenges we all face. To match with a perfect therapist for a fraction of traditional therapy, go to Talkspace.com/murder and use the code MURDER to get $45 off your first month and show your support for this program. That's MURDER, and talkspace.com/murder. Bruce, you learned an incredible amount in the investigation into Michael Swango, 00 Swango, but also that you had assembled this team, including Dr. Bodden and Dr. Readers, but along the way you added some people when necessary. You talk about another case with a nurse who kills named Gilbert Kristen, a very, very interesting case in Northampton, Massachusetts. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved with this case and what you found, what you knew immediately upon entering into this
case. Well, Kristen Gilbert was a nurse at the Northampton VA Medical Center. She allegedly killed over 30 of our nation's heroes, but we were able to prove at least three murders. But this is how it all came to light. You know, it takes a lot of courage for staff members to come forth with allegations that they think their coworker is actually killing somebody, particularly in a hospital. You know, a hospital is a setting where people take an oath to heal. You know, people have dedicated their lives to make other people better. And that's what 99.9% of our medical professionals do. Many of them perform miracles every day. So if you're in an environment where people are performing miracles, saving the lives of other people, it's pretty hard first to even fathom that somebody is intentionally murdering somebody. In some ways, and I think this was the case of Dr. Michael Swango, I think he actually chose his profession because it gave him an opportunity to kill in an environment like that. You know, look, most cops, and I put myself in this position, didn't become cops because we're good in chemistry and biology. You know, we could be very easily intimidated by the science in a hospital. And most cops don't even want to go in a hospital to do an investigation. And look, death is a common everyday occurrence in a hospital. You know, if somebody dies at your workplace, you know, there's going to be an investigation. Maybe even the police will come. Somebody dies in a hospital or nursing home. It's a daily, everyday occurrence. And look, have you ever been on a hospital ward at 3 o'clock in the morning? Not much going on there, is it? Usually based maybe a nurse's aide. And like the title of the book says, that nurse could take the curtain, pull that curtain around him or her and the patient, and nobody's going to see anything that's going on. All right. So Kristen Gilbert was such a nurse. She was a nurse in the ICU, the intensive care unit. Okay. And one of the things that Nurse Gilbert loved was the excitement code. And when I say a code, I mean that a patient goes into some sort of cardiac arrest. And the next thing you know, crash cart comes running in with all the nurses and the doctors, and she loved that excitement. And also responding to that code, of course, was a VA police officer by regulation who happened to be Kristen's boyfriend. So they sort of turned the whole entire code experience into actually some sort of semi-sexual, pleasurable experience for them. They'd be grabbing each other during the code. She actually straddled a patient once, and her dress went up, and he could see her garter belt. And she was just incredible when it came to codes. As a matter of fact, the doctors out on the staff used to say, you know, if I ever coded, I would want Kristen Gilbert there. She takes charge. She's incredible. And she would love the excitement of the coach. She'd love to show off to everybody what a good nurse she was. Now, this all comes down to this psychological condition that's known as Munchausen syndrome by proxy. And this is what we believe Kristen Gilbert suffered from, if that's the correct term. Munchausen syndrome is when a person will intentionally harm themselves and then seek the attention of caregivers because they need the love and they need the attention. And Munchausen syndrome by proxy is when a person will harm somebody else, bring that other person in the hospital to show the hospital staff what a caring person they are. There have been many cases where moms have actually intentionally harmed their children and brought a child into the hospital just to show the hospital, oh, I care so much about this child. I'm so worried about this child. Well, Kristen would actually cause the code, cause the pain and suffering of the patient just to have a code, just so she could show the staff what an excellent caregiver she was as a nurse. And she, you know what, when I first met Kristen, my vision of a serial killer had always been sort of a Charles Manson type, you know, crazy looking guy with a swastika on his forehead. And here comes a typical soccer mom. Oh, hi, everybody. I'm bringing my kids to soccer and everything's fine. Like the last person you would ever think until you started doing her background investigation, would actually be capable of murdering so many patients as she did. So what she did, she used to cause the codes, right? And like I said, her boyfriend used to respond with her. And then all of a sudden, two nurses, and this is how so many of these cases start. Two nurses noted something interesting. Seems like every time Kristen is on duty, the death rate goes up. Kristen takes a few days off, the death rate goes down. Kristen takes a vacation, the death rate is down. Kristen comes back to work, the death rate is up. Always on the ICU and always around 3 o'clock in the morning. And there were some of the most bizarre instances with Kristen that actually came out during the trial. Of course, unlike Swango, she went to trial. One of the things that came out, there was a veteran by the name of Kenneth Cutting. Now, Kristen wanted to go home early one day. She wanted to go out with her boyfriend. Her boyfriend calls up and says, hey, Kristen, if you could get out early today, why don't we go out? Kristen says, well, you know, I'm supposed to take care of this patient here. So she actually goes to her supervisor, and I'm serious with this story. She goes to her supervisor and says, hey, boss, if Kenneth Cutting should expire tonight for some reason, can I go home early? And the boss is looking at her and says, Kristen, what is that? What are you talking about? We don't expect Kenneth to expire. Well, I guess if he does, you could go home early, but I don't know. It's a crazy question. Well, guess what happened to Kenneth Cutting that night? He expired, and she went home early. She was incredibly accurate on predicting deaths. So she could see this patient, Dan, over there? He might expire around 12:33 this morning. Lo and behold, that's when it was incredible. So these nurses would come forward, and first they went to management. And let me tell you, boy, that goes over big with management. Management will say something like this. Excuse me, nurse, did you actually see Kristen Gilbert kill anybody? No, I didn't. Well, I didn't see, but every time, you know, she's on duty, the death rate goes up. She's out, the death rate goes down. Well, does that mean that she's killing people, or could there be other explanations for it? Well, I guess maybe there could be, you know, other explanations for that. And I want to ask you a question, Miss Nurse Whistleblower. Is your background so perfect? I mean, do you ever use drugs, you know, marijuana or anything worse? Is your license up to snuff? The reason why I ask these questions is because if you make these allegations, then you yourself may actually become under investigation. And you sure you want to go forward with this? Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. And I've heard this on so many cases. They'll tell the whistleblower, they'll say something like this. Mr. and Ms. Whistleblower, you know, I want to thank you for bringing these allegations forward to us. So what we do is we will appoint a board of our very best physicians in-house, of course, nobody from the outside. And they'll take a look at the medical records of these patients, and they'll make a determination if any of these patients had died as a result of their natural disease processes. And inevitably, they come back and they say, yes, these patients did die as a result of one or more of their natural disease processes, and we don't see any evidence of any foul play. Now, remember, the doctors that are doing this analysis, they all work at the hospital. They're not trained in forensics. Even the autopsy, if they should do an autopsy, which is pretty rare nowadays, It's not the kind of autopsy that a forensic medical examiner does looking for cause of death. It's more like a confirmatory autopsy. Did one or more of these disease processes result in the death of the patient? Yes. As a matter of fact, you know, when I first got involved in these cases, I would look in the patient's medical records, and many of the veterans were older and had a lot of medical problems. And I said, my God, look at all the medical problems this poor vet has, and we have to prove that he was actually murdered? I mean, it looked like any one of these diseases could have actually caused his death. Very, very difficult. So now we go with Kristen Gilbert. What's going to be the cause of death? Well, people had actually seen her remove some epinephrine. And remember, we talked about epinephrine, one of our favorite murder weapons.
Sure.
So we go once again to Dr. Reeders. And we say, Dr. Reeders, we have reason to believe that these patients were poisoned with epinephrine. And he says, well, don't worry, Bruce. I have this new machine. You remember the name, the high pressure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he comes back and he says, and this is after exhuming bodies and doing the same routine, he says, yes, we could determine that these people died as a result of receiving epinephrine they should have never received. And then the phone rings from the lab, and he says, Bruce, you know, I'm sorry, we made a mistake. We can't actually say for a fact that it's epinephrine, but have a nice trial. And here we are about to go to trial. She's already indicted on all these murder counts. But we were able to show through Dr. Bott and other physicians that the death was consistent with epinephrine poisoning. And she was actually convicted and also got 3 consecutive life terms without the possibility of parole. Now, something interesting here, something very interesting with the Gilbert case.
Sure.
Because the case occurred on a VA federal property, it was actually a death penalty case in a state that does not have the death penalty. Right? Massachusetts does not have the death penalty. So the jury had to actually decide, a jury in Massachusetts, whether she should get the death penalty or not, because this was on federal property. Well, she didn't get the death penalty. And quite frankly, we were pretty satisfied with that because she was a mother of 2 children. I think the children had suffered enough to see their mother executed. If she had been executed, she would have been the first woman executed by the federal government since Ethel Rosenberg in 1947. All right, thank goodness that happened. So anyway, she gets sentenced to prison, and I'm sitting in my office. And all of a sudden, somebody comes in with a New York Post article. Apparently, Kristen Gilbert had engaged in a love affair with Squeaky Fromm in prison. If you remember Squeaky Fromm?
Yeah.
Remember Squeaky
absolutely.
Attempted to kill President Ford?
Yeah.
So she's still looking for notoriety, Kristen, after all of this. After all of this. And those nurses that came forward and brought the allegation to us, even after management said to them, there's nothing there. Management insisted there was nothing there, but we felt different. So not only did we have to deal with the crime itself, but we had to deal with management that was actually defending the employee under suspicion. This also was very common in these kind of cases. And these people kill so many people that even when they want to cooperate, they can't even remember how many people they killed. You know, Swango, they said, how many people have you killed now that you're pleading guilty? He says, honestly, I don't remember. You know, I killed so many. I killed people in Africa. I killed people here. I killed people there. Unlike your traditional serial killers, if there is such a term, that kill maybe, you know, less than under 10, a medical serial killer could take that many people out in a week. I mean, there was a famous medical serial killer, his name was Donald Harvey, and they asked Donald Harvey when they finally caught him, and he had worked at the VA and other hospitals, they finally caught him, and they asked him that question. He says, you know, well, after I killed the first 18, excuse me? Yeah, the first 18, then I started to believe that I was actually ordained by God himself to do this because nobody questioned it. Nobody questioned it. You know, it's not so illogical if you think about it.
Yeah.
If you could kill 18 people and nobody even questions you, maybe you start to think there was some divine intervention here.
Man.
Crazy.
Thank God it didn't happen to the rest of them. Yeah, it would have really gave them an ego boost. You, what we didn't talk about, and it's a very interesting part of the story, too, is that, you know, without the help of James Perot, some of this stuff wouldn't have come out. She, her behavior, her mental illness here eventually caught up with her and this James Perot. Tell us just a little bit about what happened with James Perot, and which led to information coming out about Christian.
Yeah, well, you know,
Gilbert.
James Perot was her boyfriend, and they were hot and heavy for a while, and then she started to get crazy on him. She started to threaten him. She started to do things with his personal vehicle. Now, James Perot was a VA police officer. He was the boyfriend, and he was the one that would go to the codes. So after a while, he started to realize that Kristen Gilbert is crazy, and Kristen Gilbert actually confessed on the phone to him, saying that she did it, she killed people, and then she tried to make it seem like, ha-ha, I was only kidding. But she really wasn't kidding. She really did kill people. You know, and she had actually, now again, with Kristen Gilbert, interesting thing, remember the way we put Swango in jail for lying to the government on his application? Well, we actually put Kristen in jail for phoning in a bomb threat to the
VA
hospital. So she was in jail for a while. And by the way, when she was in jail, she was writing a book about nurse that kills people.
Yeah. Sure. Why not?
Unbelievable. I remember when we did the search warrant in her house, James Perot was there. And he started to question us, like, you know, where's your warrant? Where's this? Where that? And he knew we had all that. But he was just kind of showing off for her at the time. And that's when we found something interesting. You know, we learned that many of these medical serial killers will actually research the particular poison that they're going to use to kill people. Even though they may be MDs or nurses and know the drug, they still like to read about it. Now, pre-internet, we used to go to the library and see what books these people would take out. When we did a search warrant in Kristen Gilbert's house, we actually found a book, and the dog-eared page was on epinephrine. So we learned right away that this was her drug of choice, that she was very interested in this. By the way, she had also tried to kill her husband. She had a long history of starting fires, of scolding a child. Once you start doing a thorough background investigation on these people, you learn about their troubled life. The problem is, in many parts of the world, not only even in the United States, it's very difficult to find nurses and physicians who are willing to work. First of all, nursing is a very tough job. Nobody has more respect for nurses than I do. They're smart. They're underappreciated. They're super dedicated. And sometimes it's not easy to find nurses. You know, in some places we have to go all the way to the Philippines. Well, now we go past the Philippines. We go all the way to Korea. And you know what? If we become friends with North Korea, don't be surprised if we start picking up some of their nurses as well. In some parts of the country, it's very hard. It's a very tough profession. They have a lot of burnout. I mean, they're just the most wonderful people, but it's a very, very tough job. So the management will say, hey, look, you know what? If we didn't do such a great job on the background investigation of these people, hey, don't blame us. Look at where we had to go to find them. Have to go all over the world to find these people, you know?
Yeah.
And you know what? There have been other cases around the country of whistleblowers who have not fared well. There's a famous case about two nurses in Texas who they were actually the entire compliance department of the small hospital, these two nurses. They complained about a doctor to management, and management gave them the official answer, go back to your office, shut up. We can't find doctors here. He's not harming anybody. Go away. Well, they refused to go away, and they actually sent an anonymous letter to the state about this doctor. Well, the doctor finds out about it, and he calls the local sheriff, who happens to be one of his patients, and saying, "Sheriff, these two doctors are trying to harm me. I think they're the ones who wrote this anonymous letter to the state." So the sheriff comes in with a search warrant, goes through the nurses' computers, finds out the nurses are the ones that wrote the letter to the state, and actually charges them with the official misuse of patient information, which is a felony down in that part of Texas.
Sure.
And these two whistleblowers, all they wanted to do was let the state know about a bad doctor. Well, they go to trial, believe it or not, and the jury comes back in an hour and they say, "Are you kidding me? These nurses deserve a medal for what they did, not to be prosecuted." And they eventually sued the hospital and won. But, you know, you got to ask yourself, what kind of message is this being sent to other nurses or other medical professionals that want to come forward to report wrongdoing? They say, "Man, am I going to get arrested? Am I going to get prosecuted like these two nurses in Texas did?" I tell you, I see it all the time because I still work in hospitals all day long. There's some wonderful nurses and medical professionals who have the courage to come forward, but it does take a lot of courage, and a lot of times the hospital management will reject what they're saying without further investigation or do some half-ass internal investigation thinking that they're just going to satisfy the whistleblowers. It's a very tough environment to come forward in, and I have the world of respect for those who have done so.
Let's talk about the red flags protocol when we're on this subject, basically. How did it come to be? You talk about the A to Z. What is it? How was it implemented?
Okay, so after I had a series of these cases, I'm saying, you know what? There must be something that we could do to educate our staff on how to identify these people or what are some of the common factors that we see in all these people, and just to educate the staff to make sure that if they see something that's not right, maybe these people are actually violating one of the red flags protocols that we put together. And we noticed a lot of characteristics about these people that are very, very, very common. You know, like, for instance, they'll predict the patient's demise, and they're uncommonly accurate, you know, that they never show any remorse regarding a patient's death. As a matter of fact, you know, something interesting about Swango, I forgot to mention, after he killed the patient, he loved calling up the family. Imagine getting a call like this, calling up the family and telling them exactly how their dad had expired and suffered during his last moments. Could you imagine getting a call like that? And he did that because he was reliving the experience. He was reliving the murder over and over again. And we find that many of these people, they work that 3 a.m. shift where there's nobody else around, that they thrive on the management of emergencies, thrive on that scenario that involves an adrenaline rush. They tend to be, you know, likable and friendly sometimes, but they also tend to avoid close relationships with other coworkers. They thrive on the notoriety of being present at so many code scenes. This is so common. I could point to case after case all around the world, a recent case in Japan, Germany, a couple of cases in Italy that have surfaced. They're all the same thing. They all enjoy the excitement of a code. It's really, really pretty scary, actually. And we actually put together like an A to Z list of things that the staff needs to look for and what's common among all these cases. And we find that when people follow it, they tend to identify medical serial killers a lot sooner than having to wait, as Donald Harvey said, for the 18 people nobody questions him to happen.
The protocols are in place federally? What
no,
who,
you know what? They're really not.
Protocols?
It's on a institution by institution basis. We tried very hard to get them instituted at the VA before I retired, and there were some wonderful forensic nurses who were working very hard to make it happen. As far as I know, it did not happen. So it's all on, you know, who's been educated to this. It's almost on a person-by-person, hospital-by-hospital basis. And I should say a few words about forensic nursing, because I think maybe a lot of listeners are not familiar with this. Forensic nurses are nurses that are trained in this course, the science of nursing, but they're also trained in forensics. And they're wonderful because they can actually bridge the gap between lay people like myself and the physicians, because physicians could start talking on a language of science that I really don't understand. But forensic nurses really bridge that gap between your law enforcement types and your medical types. And I can tell you this, in a number of our cases, it was actually the forensic nurses, not the docs, and I love my docs, but it was actually the forensic nurses who determined what they thought was the real cause of death even before the doctors did. They're just an incredible group of people. And it's a fairly new field. I guess it's been around for maybe 30 years or so. It's fairly new. A lot of times we talk about them in the context of sexual assault nurses, you know, nurses that are trained to test if there's been a rape or a sexual assault. But they're really much more than that. They're really much more than that. It's just a wonderful set of people, part of any investigative team. Like if I'm going to form a team to look at an MSK, well, of course, you'll have your investigators, and you'll have your toxicologists and your medical examiners, and you'll have doctors who are experts in the particular field that the patient was suffering from. But we will also have forensic nurses, and now, of course, we add a whole new discipline that we did not originally have, and that's biomedical engineers, because everything nowadays is electronic. All your medical records are electronic. There are so many electronic devices that are hooked up to patients, but most investigators do not know that many of these devices actually record a patient's activity and history. And if you know how to examine these devices, if you know how to extract the data from these devices, you could find a lot of evidence. Because when I first went into the hospital scene, now remember, these people had been buried already, you know. So where's your crime scene? Your crime scene is what? The ICU that has already been scrubbed to surgical standards many times? I mean, what's CSI going to find there? They're not going to find anything. But believe it or not, even after the room has been scrubbed to surgical standards and everything that should have been kept or wasn't kept and thrown away, there could still be some important electronic evidence in all these medical devices that you see hooked up to the patients. Wow. But you have to know how to extract it. You have to know how to save it. You have to know how to use it. And that's now why we have a biomedical engineer on this team as well, something we didn't have years ago.
You also talk about some incredible technology in this, or utilizing a program, a computer program. You say that without it, it was just crucial in the investigation, I think, in the Christian Gilbert case, an analyst notebook.
Yes.
And you say you had a team that you called the Bruce's Angels, crucial in the Gilbert case, you said. That was a missing EKG printouts that was crucial to that case.
Yes,
as well.
And that's one of the red flags because, you know, it's funny. And as we're going through the medical records, my forensic nurses, those were my Bruce's Angels, they pointed out and they said, you know, where are the EKG strips? Now, this is before electronic medical records. They said, where are the EKG strips? Well, what do you need an EKG strip for? I said, you see, Bruce, that's like a roadmap. That will show us that the patient is doing fine, the patient is doing fine. Then all of a sudden some event happens. And that will be a map, a roadmap for us to see exactly what happened when. But they're missing because Kristen Gilbert had pulled them all out of the file. So that was a tremendous red flag, a tremendous red flag that the EKG strips were missing. But the Bruce's Angels, and this is a name that Michael Bodden gave them, these were these wonderful VA forensic nurses who had helped us during the case. They were just sensational. You know, no one investigator, I don't care if you're the reincarnation of Sherlock Holmes, you cannot do this case yourself. You need a team of people to do these cases. One thing you need, a lot of people, a lot of money, and a lot of time, which is something a lot of police departments do not have.
You also talked about, too, that we didn't mention it, is that originally you had made a proposal to the FBI when they first contacted you, as they would do in a case like this. They, with the Swango cases, you said you recommended that they jail him or convict him for those fraud and then do that necessary, take that necessary time to build a murder indictment. And yet he took the time to escape to Africa. And you say, you know, not to gloat or anything, but you say that could have saved 60 lives.
Yep. I mean, look, this is my opinion. You know, the FBI, and maybe things are better now because this goes back many years, but
sure.
You know, they just didn't cotton to the idea of another agency coming in and doing these cases. And they, and not the street agents. And certainly there's this one FBI toxicologist who I talk about glowingly in the book, Brian Donnelly. He was just sensational. But unfortunately, I ran into a lot of Federal Bureau of Arrogance in the Swango case. And we saw an example of that. Remember when that guy, Peter Strzok, testified in front of Congress? You remember
sure.
how? I mean, he just came across, I thought, so arrogant and obnoxious. I was getting like flashbacks to the time that I had to talk to them about Swango. They gave me that same arrogant and obnoxious attitude. And I said, thank God they were not involved in the Kristen Gilbert case. Thank goodness I didn't have that. But again, some of the individual agents and all were fine. It was some of the supervisors that I had a really tough time with.
Well, it's incredible work that you've done, and it's an incredible book talking about the phenomena, basically. Again, I haven't read the term officially, medical serial killers, but certainly when you have the numbers that these people did, and then all of the incredible stories that you had, like Swango behind the curtain or going to visit a young girl and a mother and telling the mother to take a hike. And then when he went behind the curtain, killed the young girl, came out and said, there you go, your daughter's dead. Go take a look. So
yeah,
this is the kind of, I mean, Killy, I mean, I don't care who you are, Bundy or Dahmer or anybody. This guy ranks right up there with the most vile of killers in history. And you include a couple more in your book as well. So, kudos to your group as well for this investigation and for the protocol and for ultimately Behind the Murder Curtain. I want to thank you very much, Bruce Sackman, for coming on and talking about Behind the Murder Curtain.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. This is a Post Hill Press. Do you have a Facebook page or a website if people want
to? Yeah, we have a website. It's behindthemurdercurtain.com. Easy to remember. And
right.
You could actually, you know, find the book on Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, or all the usual sites.
Right. Great. Well, you have a great evening, and thank you very much for coming on for this interview.
Thank you
thank
very
you.
Much, sir. Appreciate it.
Good night.
Good night.